I don't know where to begin this afternoon, but what I have in front of me is a distinguished panel, people who are movers and shakers in their respective disciplines, and folks who can hold court by themselves and often do. I'm going to introduce themselves, and I'm going to introduce the topic. To my right and your left, if you're watching, is an American Award book winner, a longtime classmate of mine, somebody who's a pillar in the hip-hop world, and somebody who's changed the game in terms of how he frames things. His name is Jeff Chang, the author of the book Can't Stop, Won't Stop, and the soon-to-be author of the book How We Do, which is the follow-up to that. Did I get it right? How
We Do? Be.
This is Who We Be. Okay,
same thing.
Next to Jeff Chang is somebody out of Tucson, Arizona, who is also a game changer. He just put out the book, Arizona, Outstate of the Union. His name is Jeff Biggers, somebody who's chronicled much of what is going on in the repressive state of Arizona, which is home to SB 1070. He is here on his panel with us this afternoon. Big shout out to you coming through. Right next to Jeff is somebody who is no stranger to our airwaves and to our show. She's an artist extraordinaire, another game changer, somebody whose posters and artwork is seen all around the world and has been an inspiration and also something that has literally moved the crowd, to quote the great Rakim. Her name is Faviana Rodriguez. How you doing, Favi?
Good, thank you.
And then we got this gentleman here from the city of Chicago, you know, where they do not pull no punches. He's an educator, an activist, also somebody who's on the front line in terms of how this generation will start dealing with the intersection of education, the attempt to privatize it, all that good stuff. His name is Dave Staval. How you doing, sir?
Pretty good about yourself.
Good, good. I wanted to bring all y'all together for a couple of reasons and have a conversation about culture, education, politics. For people in recent memory, what's going through folks' mind that would, you know, to borrow your phrase, Jeff, culture war, mm-hmm. the latest assault would be Mitt Romney mm-hmm. during the debate, where he was like wagging his finger and he's talking about, I'm going to get rid of PBS. People are kind of like, maybe, you know, mm-hmm. I'm going to get rid of health care. Maybe. But I'm going to get rid of Big Bird. And that strikes a chord with everybody. And even though many of us probably feel President Obama got his butt handed to him in that debate, Big Bird and the attack on him might be the saving grace, because folks are like, it touches a core. Mm-hmm. For me, I'm also thinking about two quotes. One coming from H-Rap Brown, now known as Jamil Al-Amin, from SNCC and the Panthers, who in 1970, gave a quote, and he talked to a large body of people, and he was saying they don't want the old heads, they want the young minds. Mm-hmm. Want to snatch these heads, they want the young minds, meaning that the opposition is going to be pulling out all the stops to go and really infiltrate the minds of young people and move them in a particular direction. 1989, Ice-T, you know, jumping forward, puts out an album called Freedom of Speech.
Just watch
you know,
what you say.
And just watch what you say, right? And in this song is a song called Lethal Weapon, which is pretty hard to find sometimes, mm-hmm. the full video. Mm-hmm. And in that song, he pretty much talks about how culture, and I don't think he articulates it the way that you did, Jeff, but he's basically like, we're going to get in the mind of these white kids, and we're going to move them to another direction, and that becomes the most frightening thing for America. This is what Ice-T is saying in 1989. Fast forward to 3 weeks ago in Oakland, California, Bobby Seale from the Black Panthers, co-founder of the Black Panther Party, unveils what he finds in his in the FBI files. They're talking about Richard Aoki and what he, you know, and all this other stuff. But he said, let me share with you what they talk about with the Panthers. And he said the Panthers were deemed a threat, not because they had guns and not because they were militant, but they were deemed a threat because they were doing a free breakfast program. Again, going after the kids. And that's what really irked J. Edgar Hoover to go after them. So now we're here at this conversation, a pivotal point. And Jeff, over the last 4 years, you've written a number of articles and you've spoken to this resurgence of a culture war. And maybe I can start off with you, because you said in order to move things politically, you're going to have to do things on a cultural tip. And you made the assertion that many people on the left, at least in the power establishment of the left, has not really embraced that, while the right is running roughshod on the culture wars. And maybe you can start, and you can set the tone and how you frame that.
Well, you know, I think all of us here at this table, and there's a lot of folks out in your audience and that kind of thing, would agree with the idea that cultural change precedes political change. And, you know, there's all kinds of examples that we could talk about. You talk about Jackie Robinson, you know, coming out in Dodger Blue on the field 7 years before the Brown versus Board of Education decision. You could talk about Ellen DeGeneres coming out on TV all these years before, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell gets repealed. There's just numerous examples. Hip-hop, in a lot of ways, I think we'd all agree, made it possible for us to imagine that there could be a black president. Right. I mean, in 2000, they did a poll of young people, and something like 60% of students of color couldn't even imagine there being a black president. But 8 years later, they were the ones that helped elect Barack Obama. So, you know, we think that if you change the culture, then you have a shot at changing the politics, that politics is sort of the last domino, so to speak. And what's interesting is, in this particular context, and I just want to defer to Jeff, because he's been covering this on the front line in Arizona, the very front line of this culture war. There's a concept that a demographer named William Fry puts out there, and it's called the cultural generation gap. And what he does is, he looks at the percentage of whites in the population over 65. The elders, the aging baby boomer generation. And then he looks at the percentage of whites under the age of 18, and he subtracts the two. And the largest gaps are in what we would call these battleground states, right? Number one, by far, is Arizona. There's Nevada, there's California, there's Texas, there's New Mexico. These are the states in which the gap between the percentage of old whites and the percentage of young whites is the largest. In Arizona, it's like something like 40%. Right. And so when we look at what's happening with the culture, right, in these culture wars, there's always a race component. That's never changed. It's always been there like that. But there's the added thing now of this generational component, and it undergirds everything. You know, this whole anti-tax movement, it's all about taking taxes away from the younger generation because they're browning. Right. It's, if you look at education, right, that's the same type of thing. We're in this crisis largely because of a lack of funding. And on and on and on and on. And it gets right down to the fundamentals, like in Texas, where they have a fight around the textbooks. And again, Jeff can talk to you about all of the stuff that's been happening there in Arizona.
Well, let me just ask you this. The realization that this country is blackening and browning catches a lot of people by surprise, because the language is being spoken, cultural language, that people ignore. Hip-hop might be one, art, dance, all these types of things that have allowed people to reimagine themselves, to navigate oppression, and really move themselves into some sort of decisive action or game-changing action. It's something that made people wake up one day and go, we have to retool this. Now, while all this is happening, we have, in my opinion, a culture war going on where people are reinforcing the dehumanization of people, black and brown in particular. So, you know, those black people are just stupid. Those brown people are, you know, they're lazy and all these things. And then one day you wake up and you go, how's he sitting in the academy? How's she going around with her art and making all these moves? So they start to retool it. Let me bring this over to you, Jeff. I would say that in order to really allow laws like SB 1070, HB 56 in Alabama to take place and actually be accepted, where people put a thumbs up and would give a 3-minute cheer to the governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer, when she shows up at the RNC, right? More than Mitt Romney and everybody else, right? She's getting a cheer, would be the cultural presentation of dehumanized Mexicans or Latinos retooled in the form of you know, turn on the TV right now. We're talking over the weekend, and it's Gangland 2, gang laws, you know, border patrols, all these different things that you tune in. And now I'm kind of used to seeing somebody of brown hue to the point that I go, probably a gang member. You probably one of those gang members that I've seen on the Discovery Channel, you know, on the History Channel, on these, you know, lofty type of institutions that are supposed to be unbiased and speak truth and do good research. I'm now inundated with that. So when you go SB 1070, you will even have some people who are a brown race going, I'm glad they're doing that because we're being overrun. But you're on the front line, and just looking at the books that they've banned, you know, over the past couple of years of last year, all those books seem to very strategically be a counter narrative to what is being hoisted. If we're saying that Chicanos, Latinos are gang members, all the books that are going out are the books that would refute that history and give a whole type of, you know, perspective of what people had to deal with, in, you know, around the issue of colonization and discrimination and all that. But you're there, so what's happening? And right. What would you add to what we're saying?
No, I think you captured it perfectly. What we're talking about in Arizona is a manufactured crisis. Mm-hmm. And so someone like me, who's a cultural historian, goes in and says, how can we be talking about this crisis of immigration when, in fact, we have the lowest rates of immigration in decades, when we have the lowest rates of apprehensions of undocumented people since 1970, when the border crime is lower than it's been in years? You know, how have they managed to actually inflame this to where we, precisely like you're saying, is people now look at Mexicans as crime, as criminals, as somehow something has gone awry, we have a crisis. And that's been the masterful approach of the Tea Party working with the Republican Party, because if we looked at the Republican agenda now, they completely have embraced this extremist role front that's come out of Arizona. We call it the Arizonification of America. Mm-hmm. And Romney was the first person to embrace it, and the Republican Party went straight with him. And they completely have embraced this manufactured crisis. So why are they manufacturing a crisis? You know, it's the shock doctrine all over again. Mm-hmm. And we've seen every 20, 30 years, you create the shock doctrine, this crisis, to ram through a far more radical agenda, mm-hmm. which is what the right-wing extreme is doing. Mm-hmm. And we saw that because I began to, you know, I'm a product of the Tucson Unified School District, and thinking, you know, we had dropout rates of 25 to 50% amongst Latinos. And here's a program that was created under a federal desegregation order. Mm-hmm. You know, in Tucson, we've been under a desegregation order.
Mexican-American
studies. Yeah, mm-hmm. but we've been under a federal desegregation order since I was a child. We're talking 40 years. They still haven't got it through to it. So they create the Mexican-American Studies program that is basically a culturally relevant curriculum. How can we plug these kids into the community? Suddenly, the scores go, and 88 to 93% of these kids are not only graduating, they're going on to college, higher test scores, completely creating not only great scholars, but great citizens. And what you are talking about with Jeff is precisely what happens. This right wing sees this cultural generation gap. They see that 80% of the gray heads in Arizona are white, they're Anglos, and 65% of the youth are Latinos. And now you have one program in Tucson that is completely empowering them, sending them out into the community. They're going off to Santa Monica and creating amazing youth programs. They're going off here, they're going off there. And this scared them. And I think this is the battle we have been fighting in Arizona for 100 years, being a border state, that the rest of the country now is facing. And that's why we're the final showdown. Because if they can smash the emergence, the reality, the inevitability of the browning of Arizona and win, then they can do it in the rest of the country. I mean, why did New Hampshire pass a copycat law? Were they afraid of fiddlers coming down from Canada? Like I said last night, we saw these things like in Florida, our Mexican food, they opened this new restaurant. Our Mexican food is so authentically Mexican, it's banned in Arizona. And we laugh at that, but then, in fact, that same company had their base in Alabama, which passed even worse laws. Mm-hmm. And of course, you just go through the South, like Sherman in Georgia and South Carolina and Virginia. And it's all a part about this historic demographic shift that is beautiful, that Cesar Chavez had predicted. He said in 1984, right here in San Francisco, he said, one day our communities will be organized and politically they'll reflect who lives in those communities. Mm-hmm. And that is what this Tea Party is trying to fight. But here's the good news I want to put in, is we are winning. Mm. And we are turning the tide. And in fact, in Arizona, the Arizonification is not only the ugliness of hatred, but it's the beauty of love and human rights that ultimately I think is going to have a far more lasting impact on America.
Right, and there's been a lot of culture weapons used in Arizona. You know, this word strike, which you've been a part of, this sound strike to get musicians to really speak this. And then Faviana, it seems like every other week you're down in Tucson, some form of fashion, and using art, you know, your own art and other people's art to really empower and bring community together. And I want to know if you can speak on it. And I really want to get your perspective because you've often said that artists have their own politics. And I think part of the challenge we have when we look at things in progressive enclaves and leftist enclaves is that, you know, we have the brain trust and then we get the artist at the last minute and then we tell you what to do. Like, I got these ideas, do the poster for me. You know, we got these strategies, you sing the song for us, you know, versus really recognizing that what you all do as artists is a language unto itself, one in which you mastered and has its own politics. So maybe you can build up on that and let us know where we're missing.
Yeah, so first I think that arts and culture is our human right. It's something that helps us think critically. And I think that the cuts to the arts that have been happening since the 80s under Reaganism and just the cuts to our public institution have made it so that we think that arts and culture is something that's a privilege to have, when in reality it's our right to express our stories and to really do it in a way that's beautiful and that allows other people to be critical about their surroundings. So that said, with immigration in particular, we have been so kind of, the right has pushed its laws. You know, when I was 16 and Governor Wilson here was the first governor. Pete Wilson was the first governor to introduce a state-based response to immigration. Mm-hmm. Before that, no other state had proposed an anti-immigrant law. And he began, this was at least 20 years ago. He began, less than 20 years ago, he began a wave of what was going to follow, which the anti-immigrant strategy was that the anti-immigrant state by state would begin to say, we're going to begin to pass our anti-immigrant laws, we're going to make it impossible for you to get a driver's license if you don't have a Social Security, we're going to work with local prisons, we're going to, you know, and here we are now where you have states like Arizona passing laws that you know, don't take into account of federal policy. So I say this because when I saw that happening, you know, as an artist, I was thinking, okay, well, they are going to get us on the policy end. Little by little, they are going to, you know, they are going to start passing laws and making our lives very difficult. And now we are so far into criminalization that if you tell anyone, hey, the word amnesty is like a bad word. Mm-hmm. When Reagan in 1986 actually passed he made it so that, you know, millions of people became legal. Mm-hmm. And he used the word amnesty. And so as cultural workers, I think that we actually need to step away sometimes. And we can't always just respond and say, you know, okay, a no SB 1070 poster, we have, you know, that's happening. No on HB 56 in Alabama. Right. We actually have to step back and say, how do we win the bigger narrative here? How do we make it so that actually the young people, just like, you know, when now it's not cool to be homophobic. And if you're in high school, you have so many gay straight alliances that it's just not something that's culturally acceptable. How do we get to that level with immigration? I think that we have to actually step back and think, as artists, how do we inspire people to see that immigrants are beautiful?
Right.
Just like the Black Panthers, you know, the whole Black Power thing, it's not something tangible. It was a kind of feeling of resistance that was created through music, through visual culture. We can do the same for immigration, and we can do the same actually for a lot of the issues. And it actually requires us, though, to take a bird's eye view, and of course to support the grassroots struggle. I think we always have to do that. But we also have to take the time.
Right.
To stop and say, how do we help our people remember that there is beauty in us? It's not just about saying we're not criminals. It's actually saying we're human beings.
Let me ask you this, Faviana. You're giving us a perspective that is more immediate, and, you know, and how you're practically able to apply or at least look at art and culture. Let's take it back and look at the connections. I said that these are languages that people speak. They're not recognized as language, and the genius behind it aren't always recognized, you know, like the Africans playing the drums, you know, in Western culture, they're just playing the drums. In Africa, each bang has a meaning. Each bang corresponds to a word. It's a form of communication. You know, you write on the wall, you know, graph artists, if we're using hip hop reference, it looks like vandalism. Somebody else is able to go, he's from here, that's his name, this is where he's from, this is the year he did it, based upon the shading of the paints and all that. And so when I look at some of your art and the art of so many others, is rooted in a long history that goes back to Mayan and Aztecs and all that. Can you speak to that? Because it seems to be part of this fight to cut that historical base off so that when you show up doing your art, it's something that we think commodity more than we think history, and it's something that happens, it's presented as something happens in a vacuum. Oh, she just does nice posters, and we don't know about the Fridas and everybody else that came before you.
Yeah, and this is actually, I also think that arts is very closely tied to our public services overall. And people don't see that, but just like, you know, we're entitled to education and health and clean environments, arts is a part of us reclaiming our history. And that's why when you know, if you think about the fact that they're banning books, they are banning works of art. In many, you know, societies where you wanted to repress people, you would go after musicians. I mean, you know, in certain places they would put them together in a coliseum and kill them. So burning our books and burning our history is not just about burning our tools of education, it's about destroying our ways of culture. And the attack on public services, the attacks on education, is also an attack on the way our cultural languages, the way that we share that. I think that part of us, you know, reclaiming our history and understanding our history of resistance as artists and as cultural workers, we, if you look at, you know, in the past 50 years, how South Africa ending apartheid, the role that artists played in that,
absolutely,
in creating this, you know, culture that really not just spoke to the, you know, inhumanity that was taking place, but also made it so that people were so excited about joining a movement. I actually, you know, speaking about the election, I noticed that actually artists were really not participating until recently. Artists, you know, there was a general disapathy, and I think that what I love my fellow artists for doing is that I think we're very honest, and I think that because we are about capturing reality and being a witness to that, we were unhappy with, you know, with what the president was doing. We were all disillusioned, and you didn't see what you saw in 2008. You didn't see the outpouring of the street artists. You didn't see, you know, the musicians come on, not until recently. And I think, like, if you look at the Sarah Silverman video, you know, the comedian, she did a video that says, you know, let my people vote. She got, I think she's now, they are now at 2 million. You saw what Samuel Jackson did, you know, and they have, I think they've stepped in because they know the urgency, but those, the power of those, what they're creating, I think just speaks to the power of art. It took the, you know, it took the...
But the artists also reflect a certain type of sentiment that is in existence in the community.
Yeah.
And with the Sarah Silverman video and Samuel Jackson and Adam Mansbach, you know, who wrote that for him, even if they got millions, it doesn't have the same buzz as it did when Young Jeezy, 4 years ago, did My President Is Black. You know what I mean? It's like, that's funny, but I'm not moved. And so it moves into the realm of commodification. It's like, we're gonna take this thing, we're gonna commodify it, we're gonna do all these things, we're gonna put it there, and I'll enjoy it, but it's not moving. Like, your art is moving people. Yeah. People are seeing those butterflies, you know, in immigration. They're like, man, I can connect. You see what I'm saying? And that's a whole different thing.
I disagree a little bit, because with the voter suppression laws, in general, people, it's kind of a clunky thing to understand.
Right.
It's not something that necessarily interests you. The mainstream is like, okay, I kind of care, but I don't really get it. The she was able as an artist to capture in a, such a small way that she educated so many people through comedy. And she was able to actually get people saying, oh, what? Like, I actually need to do something. That's right. The power of the artists is that they inspire. I think that the fact that you don't have the outpouring of artists you had before speaks to the general. We are disappointed in the immigrant rights sector as an artist that works in immigrant rights. Of course, I'm disappointed. I'm very hesitant to make a poster celebrating a president who has deported over 1 million people. You know, and however, I do think that what Sarah Silverman did exposing the voter suppression laws is. You know, that's a story that needs to be told, and it's so brilliant right. that she said it in that way, you know?
No, I agree with you. And I guess I'm conflating both Samuel and hers. They're two different things, and you're right. Dave Saval, I want you to put on your education hat. You're mm-hmm. in the belly of the beast mm-hmm. in Chicago on two fronts. One, when I say the belly of the beast, we're looking at Arne Duncan coming out of Chicago, who is spearheading Barack Obama's education policy. And within that education policy, we hear a lot of things that I think people would sum up to be job training. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to go to colleges, and we're going to have job training, and we're going to get you to school, and you're just going to take math and science, and that will prepare you for jobs. But what I've seen, and as an educator myself now, is a lack of critical thinking. Mm-hmm. I see a disinterest in history, especially with black people, mm-hmm. which is very frightening. And from your standpoint, being in there, can you talk about the relationship of culture and education, especially when it comes to education now and budget cuts, they're going, let's take out all these types of things that I feel are critically important mm-hmm. for us, especially as black folks. Mm-hmm. But you can expound on that.
Well, this thing that I think that all of the folks today mentioning, and just going back in terms of thinking about this actually as manufactured but not conspiratorial. And I think that sounds funny when I say it that way, right?
Okay.
But this thing is part of a larger process. When Fabiana talks about our rights as human beings to create, systemically, there have been states that have deemed that the most unimportant. And we know that that actually is the most important for historically oppressed groups,
yeah.
right? So this, if we look at that particular set, and this goes back to the framing of the Constitution, whether it be the Three-Fifths Clause, or whether it be the actual language of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, mm-hmm. right? So if we actually look at this space, and we talk about these jobs that are supposedly coming from some place, we haven't really defined where the space is coming from. But what we see in our communities is that folks who have historically gotten the least are getting even less. And there's a rationale for it. So if we look at education and we look at this race at the top, we look at not even Arne Duncan, but Paul Vallis before him, mm-hmm. who went from Philly to New Orleans to Haiti to Chile, right?
Wow.
In terms of actually leading educational efforts.
And Chile is in disruption right now. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people on the street.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Over education,
right? And who's in that space? Paul Vallis, coming from Chicago, who went to Philly and tried to charterize the district, goes to New Orleans, bombs the district, goes to Haiti, and creates a small set of programs to create another elite class, and now goes to a place where there's more unrest.
Wow.
So if we think about that particular transformation or that development, it's not this thing as clandestine, right? This is actually happening and very public. But another thing that happens, and I think it's important to think about this, is layers. Because in a place like Chicago, the desperation of families is being played upon. So we tell folks that you've had 40 years of madness. Here's something new. But in that layer, here's this new thing. You might not be able to go because you don't have a place to live, because we've now got rid of 80% of our public housing stock. And we've raised the rent in some places by 300% and quadrupled taxes in some areas. So now you don't have a place to live, let alone a place to go to school. But if you are allowed to go to that particular school, you can be kicked out for all these arcane reasons, right? Yeah. Wrong colored shoes,
yeah.
no disciplinary infractions, but actually failing two consecutive semesters, because those schools now need to show increase in standardized test scores. Mm. Now let's drop another layer on that. the psychometricians who actually write standardized tests have actually said wholeheartedly, so whether it be ETS, ACT, or the College Board, so that's all the major college admissions tests, GRE, GMAT, and your smaller tests that are issued in states, they've all said that these tests should not be used for high-stakes instances and have no predictive value. So this is by the people who've written these things, right?
But it's been flipped the other way.
Right, so now these are by the people who have written these things, but yet we're caught into this framing that now high test scores are this thing that demonstrates you know how to do a particular thing. But what high test scores often tell us is that you take a test well, right? According to the psychometricians who have actually created them. Right. But this thing around looking at that, and going back to Fabiana's point around when we disable our ability to create, right? We get more into this order and compliance. And for many of us, this order and compliance works to our detriment. And that, I think, is really important.
So you become a good worker bee.
You become a good worker bee with no analysis of your situation. It is what it is, right? And opposed to saying, well, there's something sizably wrong with this. There's something that has actually affected folks in a disparate way, but in a disparate way for the last 350 years. Just different names to it.
You also get the school to prison pipeline where you have prisons building according to what the test scores are in the fourth grade, and that if the students don't meet certain requirements, then you have the whole suspension track and then the truancy track, and before you know it, they are on the pipeline to prison track.
And here's what we see in Chicago. So Chicago Police Department actually releases their arrest data, and they release their arrest data by district and zip code. So we know we can go to eight particular neighborhoods in Chicago, and we see two things. We see that those eight neighborhoods' zip codes have two particular pieces. They have the highest arrest rates, and more importantly, they have the highest recidivism rates. And recidivism, for your viewers who haven't heard that term quite a bit, recidivism just means those who have entered correctional facilities who are re-entering,
right?
So if we look at those recidivism rates, the population that has this high arrest rate and high recidivism rate is now getting younger and becoming more female.
So if we pay
attention to that, I don't want your viewers to think about this conspiratorially, right? I want folks to understand this as a manifestation of the ways in which policies are enforced.
Well, it's very methodical.
Right.
What I want to do is ask the voice of Dave Stavalio. So I heard Fabiana Rodriguez and Jeff Biggers and Jeff Chang. I want to take a break. And when we come back, I want to build up off this point with all of you where Dave Stavalio said rationale. And I would contend that culture leads to the rationale of dehumanizing people. And I want to also come and talk to each of you all about the commodification of culture and how many of us, I think, out of desperation, will play into it. We will literally sell our souls to get ahead in a society that doesn't see us as human in the first place. So let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll build on that.
Cool.
We're continuing our conversation, culture, education, politics, culture wars. And before we left to the break, our guests, Jeff Chang, Jeff Biggers, Fabiana Rodriguez, and David Staval, all educators, artists, journalists, the whole nine. I had left you with the question about rationale. Rationale to continue dehumanizing, rationale to continue taking away from those who need it most. Rationale to basically look at folks who are down and out and say, you kind of deserve what you get. And I would say that culture has played a big role in fostering that type of mindset. Maybe you all can comment a little bit on more recent manifestations, but I think back immediately to Birth of a Nation and what that meant. You know, when newly freed African Americans or enslaved people suddenly found themselves at the short end of the stick, thanks to D.W. Griffith's very powerful, groundbreaking movie that even the president at that time, I was going to say Calvin Coolidge, but I think it was Wilson, said, you know, it's like history and lightning or something like that, and had a private screening of in his White House. But we've seen this go on and on over again. I mean, it's nothing new, but I think for a lot of folks, part of the culture wars has been removing history. So even though we all know this story, a lot of people listening and watching is going, I never knew about all this. So let's start about this, how culture is being used to rationalize some of the demonization that we see of black, brown, young people, gays, what have you. And as you said in between the break, let's talk about the pushback that's going on. So I'll start off with you maybe, Jeff.
Well, I mean, I think it's really interesting that in 2008, as Fabiano was talking about, you have this explosion of images, right, of a black man as a symbol of hope, as a symbol of progress, as a symbol of change. Literally, his picture and the word hope or the word progress underneath it. And so that becomes a powerful image, and that actually circulates in a meme-like kind of way, right, in a viral kind of way. It's the kind of thing that one person picks up, and then other people are like, oh, yeah, I get that. And then you have at the base of that a bunch of cultural organizers, people like Yossi Sargent, who are down there in the trenches getting artists to be able to create these images. But these images create more images and more images and more images. So it's like a wave of all of these different types of images that comes out. And that actually helps in many ways the election process. Although at that particular point, and I think since then, we've been able to think about this in terms of Obama as an image versus Obama as a politician. I think we can talk a lot about that. Favi referred to it in terms of talking about the immigration debate. But what I guess I'm trying to say is immediately you begin to see these counter images, right? Obama as a witch doctor, right? Obama with chicken, Obama with watermelon. And so there's these counter images that try to come into play immediately. And so the point is that as much as it's possible to be able to create this wave, that there's always these other waves that are also crashing at the same time. That culture is like the ocean. It keeps on pushing back and forth. There's all these currents that are moving in this direction, and there's these currents that are kind of moving back.
Do you make a mistake when you try to commodify it? And I would say that Barack Obama was maybe one of the first to commodify on the culture tip, because he very skillfully tapped in to the whole Martin Luther King legacy, even though his policies bear very little resemblance. Mm-hmm. His intonation, you know, his cadence when he speaks, and allowing people to put those posters of King to Obama, mm-hmm. you know, brought up literally tears in people's eyes come Inauguration Day, only to find that, you know, everything that King stood for, not only in policy, but also his willingness to cut off everything that would be coming to him to stand on principle, is not something that you see Barack Obama do. You know, King is a principled individual. Barack Obama is a politician, meaning that he'll take your image and your words and, you know, your thoughts and put them in a thing and get reelected, and it might be at your expense. You know what I mean? And that's a form of commodification with no accountability. But, you know, your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, okay, so one of the most popular images shortly after he was elected was the image of the Old Spice guy. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have this picture of this, right? You have a picture of a black man on a white horse. Now, that wouldn't have happened if Obama hadn't gotten elected, right? So you could argue that Old Spice commodified Obama's image, right, in order to sell a whole lot of like body wash, right? And I think that's like part of what happens, right? Is as fast as the images move, the counter images and the images that are coming up behind it move as well.
So what are we supposed to do?
Well, I think that as folks who are interested in the art and in the culture and that kind of stuff, we have to be thoughtful and strategic about how we're doing this kind of stuff. And that's sort of what we've been trying to do with Culture Strike, which is Word Strike and Art Strike, and we're affiliated with the Sound Strike. And that is to try to figure out ways in which we can organize artists to think about how we are pressing our advantage on different types of things. I think that the thing that was exciting about 2008 is that it felt sudden. It felt like, you know, it wasn't, because there was a buildup, right? All of this hip-hop activism going to Prop 21 in California and beyond that, right? With all the folks who've been organizing.
Auditorium, yeah, all that sort of
all
stuff.
All the folks working on prisons, on police brutality, and on education, right? All through the 90s and stuff, on up to 2000. And then through that to the National Hip Hop Political Convention and the hip hop organizing that went in to 2006 and 2008, right? With the League of Young Voters and the Hip Hop Summit and all these other folks, Vote or Die. All of that was sort of the lead up to this, but it felt sudden. It felt like a light had been turned on and that all of a sudden all of this stuff was going to begin to happen. So that just points out the importance of strategy and of organizing and of like thinking through, in the same way we think about community organizing, thinking about how we change culture.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, go ahead, Dave.
This, and just on Jeff's point, I think this is huge around reframing, right? So reframing the problems. So I think this is the success. We talk about successes. This is a success of the Chicago Teachers' Strike. It was reframing the image around a union solely being concerned about the protection of jobs. The reframing was, in order for us to do our best work as teachers, we need these things to be in the forefront, like gentrification, high stakes testing, school depopulation, displacement. We have to, the return of counselors and social workers to the space. We need this understanding that those who have historically had the least are getting even less, and to put that back on the table. So that reframing of issues. So in the popular media, the national media, it was all this tension around, well, where the parents are complaining about childcare. That wasn't the case on the ground.
Right.
People were actually there saying, if these teachers have put their lives on the line to say, we want the best that we could humanly get for our students, here's the way that we frame it.
And they didn't see that coming.
Exactly.
Because the national media did cover it as, you know, just those
strike.
Greedy teachers,
right.
You know, want more money in a recession. But everybody I talked to in Chicago had a very strong different thing. It's not about money. You know, even cats with gold teeth and, nah, man, it's not about money. It's about, and it's like.
But this, and it's one thing, just a quick thing about the legislation. So Stanford Children comes to Chicago and they actually push on the Illinois legislature to create a law that says that you had to get, to get a strike vote, you had to get 75% of your membership to vote yes, right? So Josh Edelman is caught on tape at a Denver conference saying, I stuck it to the union. They'll never be able to get 75% of their membership. Now, not of your voters, but your membership to vote, right? 23,000 teachers in Chicago,
right.
Or 25,000 staff when you put them all together, right? Through their organizing and reframing, they got a 90%
wow.
yes vote from their membership. So that reframing was huge, yeah. Despite this organizing to
so
make sure
have,
that they couldn't.
So we definitely have right. to master that.
Right.
And that's where Arizona comes in. And I think
this
that's
is
what
Jeff
we're
Baker speaking.
You know, we're trying to do as cultural workers. You know, I see my role as an artist and a cultural historian who suddenly now is thrown into the newsroom. Mm-hmm. Because, in fact, the framing of what happened in Arizona mm-hmm. to me, not only disseminated a tremendous amount of misinformation, for example, about immigration and whatnot, mm-hmm. but it completely denigrated and neglected an incredible fight back that wasn't being covered. And so as an artist who said, hey, we have to, even the liberal media, for example, there's these young journalists who won the Pulitzer Prize right. for investigating Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the toughest mm-hmm. sheriff in America that everybody's obsessed with. And they won the Pulitzer Prize for showing how he had mismanaged his force, 300 sex crimes case, including rape of children, had been neglected because of his obsession, these dragnets in the Latino communities. And the same day they won the Pulitzer Prize, Colbert Nation had Joe Arpaio on for a memoir that he not only had not written, he had never read. And he was yucking it up. And I kept thinking, wait a minute. You know, this is the voices of resistance. This is the voices there on the front lines about something that's critical we're missing.
I think you touch upon what I was implying earlier. There's this disconnect. Mm-hmm. There's a punditry class. You know, it could on one side it could be the John Stewart types. On the other side, it could be a lot of black academians mm-hmm. that have, in a cultural sense, have positioned themselves like you're on TV, so we assume that you did due diligence mm-hmm. in what you're about to speak. But the reality is that you find these huge disconnects. So Colbert puts Joe Arpaio on not knowing about the resistance. I don't know how many black pundits we saw around Trayvon Martin mm-hmm. that talked about Skittles and hoodies and vigilante justice. And quite naturally, you know, all of us who are here, we go, vigilante? Oh, yeah, this is going on in Tucson. So when you get up on TV, you're supposed to make those connections. You know, Trayvon is no different than what's going on in Arizona. And you saw pundit after pundit just go, hoodies and Skittles, and never make that connection, which gets frustrating because now, in a cultural sense, they might be black, brown, woman, or whatever. People assume that they're representing all of us, when in fact, there is a small swath if they're missing these big pieces.
Right. Well, I'll give you just one little example. You know, take the Daily Show. They refer to Arizona as the meth lab of democracy. And we yuck it up, and it's hilarious. But at the same time, it's very demoralizing for the fact that the very architect of SB 1070, Russell Pierce, this fringe character, you know, part of the 10th Amendment movement, who doesn't even believe he's a citizen of the United States, but a citizen of the sovereign states. He's George Wallace times 10 in terms of states' rights. He's the man who has defined the Republican Party's immigration policy. And this young group of Latinos with a labor organizer got together with this very diverse coalition. They went to arguably the most conservative district in America. They began a recall, and the recall comes from our radical labor movement from 100 years ago, Mexican-American miners, and they actually took Pierce out. Yes. It was the most important news story last year that for the first time in American history, a Senate president was taken out in a recall, the architect of SB 1070. And that night I turned on TV, and we talked about Wisconsin. We talked about Mississippi. And then we turned to the meth lab of democracy with our late night jokes. And to me, that was incredibly disrespectful to this powerful shift, this resistance, this other voice that, once again, it became the burden of us artists to say, we have to help get this voice out, but we also have to help frame it for the national media.
Was it important for you to write a book? So, because in our culture, that book has a certain type of currency. Mm. It's like you put this in a book, now all of a sudden it opens up the door. You're not just Jeff Biggers journalist or Jeff Biggers artist, you're Jeff Biggers author. Exactly. Now we get to sit down on the seat. So does that make a difference in when you chronicle that in that way?
No, completely. But it's also a lesson that the kids in Tucson taught me. The kids took over the school board in April 26 because they were going to shut down their Mexican-American studies program. And nobody was supporting them. Mm-hmm. And they said, our history matters. We're willing to fight back. We literally took over the school board, chained ourselves in this incredible act of civil disobedience. And they wanted to say, hey, public education in Tucson was founded by a Mexican immigrant who was the only person who stood against the Confederacy. When they took over Tucson, we became a slave state. It was a Mexican immigrant. That same man created our public school system. And in fact, that history of resistance is why we're here and why we're fighting. And as a historian, it's like, I got to get that history into the books to not only show we're a state out of the Union now, but we've been fighting for 100 years to put us back into the Union.
When we look at what's going on in the removal, in the fight around textbooks, they're taking out those resistant things. Nat Turner's not talked about no more. Denmark Varsity is gone. The 200 to 300 slave revolts are all but, you know, now you sound crazy saying, you know, the slaves revolted like 300 times.
Capitalism becomes free market economies.
Yeah, yeah. In terms all of these language. Things. Oh. I want to change the gears slightly. One of the things that you, Faviana, were involved with, I think, was a culture war in a sense of getting rid of Lou Dobbs. And one of the things that I found very admirable and I talked to people about was the day that you all had the 16 city press conference. And I remember you were in the studio here. And CNN at the time was calling person after person. And you know, you even got calls. Would you like to come on CNN and discuss this issue? And in a cultural sense, being on TV is big news. And y'all were like, nah, we ain't going. No, there was no cheesing for CNN. And even the woman that they put in Latinos in America, which was there, like, we'll appeal to you by doing this. She was basically like, yeah, I'm in it, but F CNN, you know? And I was like, wow. And I contrast with the multitude of people that have rushed, many from the left, that will go to the Fox Newses and the Bill O'Reillys and give them some sort of validation. Like, we got the mayor of San Francisco on, so it must be real, where they are clowned, demeaned, and, you know, disparaged, and your movement ridiculed. But you all didn't do that. And maybe, can you speak to the importance of maintaining a certain type of empowerment in spite of what outside offerings may imply?
Well, first, you know, talking about culture, Lou Dobbs was one of the kings of anti-immigrant culture. He very carefully crafted for 10 years, and actually the right wing, I think, is very good at framing, and he was one of the main champions of pushing out the word illegal on TV and saying that illegals were murderers and rapists, and they bring malaria over, and he actually said illegals make up one-third of the prison population. Mm-hmm. I mean, he could say things like that that were just completely not true, but the amount of reach he had and his viewership and just that he was able to create this culture of fear. So he is one of those cultural icons that as a Latina and as a, you know, someone who's first generation here, he had to be removed just because, you know, he's being touted on CNN's most, you know, the most trusted news network in the United States. So when we ran a campaign against him, it was very important first to delegitimize him, but also point the finger at John Klein, the president, and really make CNN accountable for this fringe character
that
they had.
That's why y'all didn't empower by going on the TV.
Exactly. He wanted us to go on and have a debate. If you look at how Lou Dobbs has debates, and I mean, he had people like Janet Mudhia from the NCLR, very dehumanizing, but also allowing him to set the terms, you know, and really, you know, going into his space, and especially when our campaign was not against Lou Dobbs, it was actually against CNN. CNN at the time was trying to release Latinos in America, which was kind of their whole way to come into the Latino market. They know that Latinos were a huge emerging market. They wanted a part of that. It was great that at the time they wanted a part of that, we're like, oh, okay, you want a part of the Latino market, and yet every single night you're dehumanizing Latinos on TV. It's not going to happen. Whenever they came to a state, Soledad O'Brien would come talk about Latino in America. She would be interrupted by people saying, well, what about Lou Dobbs? So their entire effort to enter the Latino market, if you look at all the reporting that came out of that, they were saying CNN wants to release Latino in America, but they're very conveniently ignoring Lou Dobbs. So we were able to get into the story and frame it as a moral dilemma for CNN and really say, CNN, you can't have this and want that. That is something around framing that where you say very simply, you can't be two-faced, CNN. Mm-hmm. And so by us not kind of...
And then you put those posters out that reminded us of it.
Right, CNN, you can't have in both ways, and really using the CNN logo to affect their brand. I mean, that's another power of culture, is that companies, corporations love their brand. And when you as cultural workers, we can attack their brand and expose what they're doing. We at Presente.org, we refused to go on to interview with him. And we kept pushing John Klein. And then, you know, within a few weeks, he was off the air.
Dave, let me build off that, because one of the things we find is that a lot of black folks who now in many places are becoming the face of imperialism around the world, which is an ironic situation. Mm-hmm. You know, you go around the world now and it's like, you know, you have a Condi Rice, you have Colin Powell, you have black soldiers, and you have people like USA, and you're like, wait a second, you know. So the image of the Malcolm X's and Panthers had been replaced by a certain type of image with black folks. But when you contrast the discipline that was exercised when they were fighting Lou Dobbs to not legitimize him by going on, and people told that line, and then you turn around and we see, like, when Shirley Sherrod was demonized by Fox, and that night after it was revealed that they got her, you know, that they set her up, you have black folk after black folk going on there talking about, I gotta go represent. What's missing there? Or is there legitimacy in going into the beast and fighting that way?
Well, the thing is, I think what we learned from folks like Fabiola, in terms of looking at a very age-old principle, if you're actually gonna do that work, one, you cannot do it alone. You can't go into those spaces by yourself, because that's the easiest way to pick you off. That's the easiest way to isolate you.
Right.
I think the second thing that comes is that you have to be very intentional around framing. Because, again, it's another play. I look at this as another play on our desperation, right? Because some folks are so desperate to be heard and think that our imagery, because it's been so castigated since we've had visual and video images of ourselves has been so castigated that anybody that quote unquote looks respectable represents this modicum of progress. Mm. And that's not the case. And we have to be very clear about that, right? So, and this notion around a larger colonial project, right? Sure, there can be a Condoleezza Rice. Sure, there can be a Colin Powell. Sure, there can be a President Barack Obama. But let's not get it twisted. What does the Office of the President do? What does your chief security advisor do? If you look at Susan Rice, who I actually think has some critical perspectives, right? But what does it actually mean to be the national security advisor at this moment when we got Libya, Syria, the Middle East?
And AFRICOM and all that.
And AFRICOM. And what does it actually mean in those spaces? And what we have to have is that analysis, but television can become so polarizing, right? So it can actually split you in these ways and not actually analyze the layers. So I think this notion around it goes right back to the schoolhouse, right? What does it mean to support young folks in a critical analysis of their world and actually mm-hmm. working with those to change their conditions? Not at just the individual level, but yeah. at the collective level so they can actually see themselves in other people. So that, I think that changes our dynamic. But when you do that, and as everybody mentioned, and we have to be clear about that, when you do that, that's instantly a threat.
Well, let me go around the table. Two or three steps that people need to take to change that dynamic,
I think,
culturally speaking.
I think, culturally speaking, one of the things that we can do is take nothing for face value. I think another thing that we can do is actually look at the folks who actually are willing to engage things at a deeper analysis beyond a soundbite. I think three, investigate those organizations that have actually doing work on the ground with communities and are transparent in their process of addressing the issues and concerns. I think those three things are critical if we're going to move in ways that change our condition.
There's a language that's spoken that we need to recognize. There's a deep history that most of the art that we do, whether we know it or not, is connected to ancient times, mm-hmm. you know, from hip hop to painting on down. And we need to know that. And we need to ask ourselves the question, why do they want to disconnect that history? You know, if they were banning rap songs, they were banning the drum. There's a connection. If they are talking about, banning books, you know, they were banning all sorts of things that connected us to our roots, and that needs to be recognized. And I'll just conclude that this is a community, and I think the most important thing that I get out of this is that art brings people together. And when you start to bring people together, that becomes frightening. This conversation becomes frightening. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at the power, the diversity, and the people that you all represent geographically mm-hmm. and what have you, it's like, whoa, we can't have too many more of these type of conversations because it empowers people. And if we kind of keep our focus on that, I think that, you know, we'll win. And stop legitimizing people who don't legitimize you. Mm-hmm. You know, that to me, I think, is most important. You know, I mean, we give our talent and our art away to record labels and TV stations and radio outlets that don't care about us. We sell our souls and don't get anything in return collectively and individually. So I want to thank you all for giving people food for thought. We're out for now. Peace.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.